a variation on twisted field theories and dualizability in the Morita category. Somehow, I apologize for the very mathematical title. For more physically interested people, it's more something like states and observables and a factorization algebra point of view on it. So let's start with the mathematical framework that we'll be working in. So if anything of this is unfamiliar, I wasn't sure how much to repeat, please interrupt. So I'll be talking about, we will start with fully extended, or maybe not necessarily fully extended yet, topological field theories. So according to, I mean, this is an approach to quantum field theory, which goes back to Atiyah and Siegel, which you've probably all seen at some point, and a functorial approach to giving an axiomatization of what a field theory is supposed to be. So the mathematical way of phrasing this is you take a nice category, and I will explain what that is in a minute, and we want to get an assignment. So the assignment should do the following thing. So this is summarized, the properties are summarized in terms of a symmetric monodal category. So we have objects. The objects will be spaces. And by spaces, I mean closed n-dimensional. And usually we'll mean smooth manifolds. And this assignment here should, to this space, assign a state space. So a vector space or a Hilbert space. Which are kind of the space of the quantum states. And then what are the morphisms in this category? So in the next, the second layer of my assignment will take in space times. So now I add my time direction. And this is summarized in terms of, I did the wrong shift. This should be n minus one dimensional. And here I will have n dimensional Bordisms. I will explain what this is in a minute. Just as a picture, you should think of something like this, going from here to there. That's the time direction. And what you associate to it is an evolution operator. So this will be, in Hilbert space is some unitary operator, or vector space is just a linear operator. All right, so what's a Bordism? So it's an n-dimensional manifold with boundary. And my boundary, as I suggestively drew here, has an in part and out part. And the next step is somehow we want a certain compatibility between this assignment. So it's a functor of categories, which means that if I compose things here, I want to get a composition here. So how do I compose? I take a Bordism like this, and then another Bordism. As I suggested, I want to glue over this piece in the middle. And to make this gluing work, since we were working with smooth manifolds, actually I have to take here diffeomorphism classes of. For example, there are other ways to fix this, but this is one possibility. Okay. So this is just a topological field theory at the moment, n-dimensional. What makes it topological? Well, I already said we want to have the smooth structure here. I could add more structure. I could add, for example, an orientation, a framing, principal G-bundle with a flat connection. Those are all examples of topological situations. We could have chosen something more general here and then had to work a little bit more here, had to make this composition work, but there are variations thereof, like including a conformal structure or so. But we won't really be talking much about this today. So the first part will work for non-topological situations, just the framework. But then all the characterizations and the examples will be actually topological ones. Okay, so this is somehow the classical setup. I didn't tell you yet. This is supposed to be a symmetric monoidal category. So I have to give you some sort of a monoidal structure, and that will be very easy here. It's just taking disjoint unions. So if I can take disjoint unions of manifolds. And what should it go to on this side? Well, it should go to the tensor product of the state spaces. If I take a disjoint union of spaces, the Hilbert space should multiply. All right, so we have a definition. First question is, are there examples, right? And so for n equals 1 and n equals 2, it's very easy to not only give first examples of this, but actually to classify them completely. And we won't really discuss this here, but as you can kind of see here, it's all determined by what happens with these like n-dimensional manifolds. So for n equals 1 and n equals 2, there's a classification of n-dimensional manifolds with boundary, and that just allows you to classify these. So the question is now that relied on somehow knowing how these manifolds with boundary look like. And so for higher dimensions, this starts becoming very difficult. Okay, so maybe write one word. So for n equals 1, 2, we can classify them. And we get that if we take, this is functors, and now here I will just for simplicity, because this is the easiest way to write it, I take the oriented situation, and then actually these are fully determined by a finite dimensional vector space. And you can do a similar thing in the two-dimensional case. And how this goes is that you take your assignment z, and you send it to its value at a point. So we will, you see that here we have this finite dimensionality condition appearing. And this is somehow what we will be aiming at to try to find situations where we can relax this finite dimensionality condition. So also in higher dimensions, you will get examples always in this topological situation will impose finite dimensionality conditions on the objects that are allowed by the TFTs. And this is somehow where we want to relax our conditions a little bit. That will be the goal. So so I added an adjective here, fully extended. So somehow it was convenient to arrange it in this way. We had n minus 1 and n-dimensional manifolds. But somehow it seems a little arbitrary to just stop there, right? I mean, why not? Like, I mean, if you want to decompose a manifold, like often you do this via triangulation or something like that, and there you really want to know more about like codimension things. Or physically, I mean, why do you just want to have a domain wall? I mean, you could kind of introduce more kind of corners or something like that. So the problem is here, it was very convenient to just summarize, okay, we have a symmetric monoidal category, we have these two layers. So now if we want to kind of implement this idea of adding more codimensional pieces, we have to just find a different framework to summarize what happens on this side. And this this is what's meant by being extended over here. So rather than having, and I will now suggestively write board n minus 1 n, I will replace this with something where I have, I should write it the other way around, n minus 1, but I don't stop. I can go to any codimension. I could even go, I mean, for example, I can go all the way down to 0. Okay. So the idea here is that we want to make this into an a structure where now my objects are the zero-dimensional manifolds. Morphisms are one-dimensional cobordisms, so that's exactly what we had before.
And now we add extra layers of structure. Now between two one-dimensional Bordisms, for example, I could take this one, and I could take this one. Now I add a next step somehow. Now here, that's where the two-dimensional guys will go. So this will be a two-dimensional Bordism of Bordisms. So this corresponds to adding a two-dimensional picture in here. Okay. So this is will be called two morphism. This will be called one morphism. And then I can go on. I can continue. I will get manifolds with corners at every step, but this is just somehow a way of phrasing this idea that I want to be able to intersect pieces. So now, it was very convenient before to just be able to say Z should be a symmetric monodal functor of categories. And now here we have these N layers. So this should be organized in an N category. But it turns out that, like, from a categorical point of view, it's not easy to formulate what this is. And I won't bore you with the details, just to tell you, actually turns out to be way more useful to phrase this in terms of infinity N categories, where you kind of add stuff at the top, which corresponds to the diffeomorphisms. But this is not so important for what we're doing today. So now, this object here, this gadget here, I can take this as the thing that I base my system on. Okay, so now if I ask for a functor out of this thing, this will be an assignment that assigns something to all of these pieces. So the top dimension, the n-dimensional piece, is somehow the thing where you want to get at. This is what should, if you have a closed thing here, you want to get numbers. But then if you take a codimension one piece, that somehow should give you somehow a defect between these things. So fully extended NTFT is just a functor out of this new category here. And we have to find a good replacement of what to put here. OK, so what is an example of what we can put here? So what we want to still keep, what we still want to keep is somehow the property that at the top, we should definitely get numbers. OK. Maybe I should explain why you get numbers here. Is this clear to everybody? Would you like me to show this? Why you get a number here at the top? Yes? No? Maybe? Who wants to see it?
Sure, Davide knows it already. Sure, Davide knows
it. Okay, so if we take a Bordism, if we take an n-dimensional manifold, where the boundary is empty, I can view it as a Bordism from the empty set to the empty set. And so Z being symmetric monoidal says that the empty set will be sent to the ground field, K. So let's take vector spaces just being C. It just goes to C. And on this other side as well. And so we get a linear map from C to C. And if you take the image of 1, it will be a number. So if you're talking about TFTs and getting invariants from the TFTs, this is the number you're getting at. Okay. So we still want to retain this property that at the top you get numbers. And this is the only somehow property that we want for this funny thing here. So one example, so for n equals 2, we want something with a two-layered structure, which kind of fits to this. So here, one example is to take something where now what I call the lowest level, the objects, will be C algebras. And the next level, these one morphisms, will be bimodules. So that means I have a vector space A with an action of an algebra on the left and an action of an algebra on the right. And my two morphisms between them. So now if I have another one, I will get a homomorphism here, which is compatible with this action. So why does that give me the invariance again? Well, if I take A and B to be just C itself, well, then this is just a vector space. This having a bimodule is no extra structure. So we have a vector space here and a vector space there. And then I can repeat the argument that we just did here.
Are there any additional conditions on this F except of it being homomorphism?
It's a linear map from M to N, which is compatible with the action of A on both sides. So that if I take F of A, M, that's A times F of M. And the same with B. That's all. It's just an intertwiner. So for those of you who know what fusion categories are, you will see, you will be happy about the next example. So you can do something like taking objects being tensor categories. Morphisms are, so tensor category means I have a category with a monoidal structure and plus finiteness properties. But in particular, I have a monoidal structure here, so I can ask for a bimodule. And now the two morphisms, now I kind of repeat what I, yeah. So now I can use my morphisms of categories. So I could put functors here, which are, again, compatible with this bimodule structure. And the three morphisms will be natural transformations, again, compatible with the previous structure. And now here, in particular, objects that you will get are fusion categories. Okay. So now here, really, fusion categories are particular cases. So why am I doing this? The nice thing here is that if you go all the way down to zero, there is indeed a classification of these TFTs. You can really kind of determine all of them. And it really goes the same recipe as before. You evaluate at a point. And in fact, you get into a part of C, which is called the n-dualizable part. So it's just certain objects in C which have certain finiteness properties. It's the same as before. We had certain objects in vector spaces which have finiteness properties. And actually, this gives an equivalence in a good sense of infinity cuboids. It's not so important. So in this situation here, the fusion categories are examples of these guys. So that means if you want to get 3D TFTs with this target, fusion categories give you good examples.
Are fusion categories exactly the dualizable ones? Or is...
I think no. So according to Krishna Priest, they're not exactly sure. Okay. So they give oriented 3D TFTs, but they know that they give examples. I think it's not yet quite clear whether they're really all of them.
How this evaluation at the point is defined? Like,
so you take such an assignment, and so now an object, if you think of an object, is zero-dimensional manifolds. So in particular, there's one that's called point. And now the assignment tells me what to do with the point. So my assignment took something here and evaluated to be in here. So the image of the point will be an object in here. I should have said here this is the framed situation, but it's not so important for today. Okay, if you like modular tensor categories, I will tell you that there is an analogous situation here for n equals 4, where the objects, in particular modular tensor categories, give objects. Okay, so these are all somehow things that appear because, I mean, there are certain objects in nice categories, and they give these n-dualizable objects. So, yes. So the problem, however, with those examples is, just as before, we had to be really a TFT, you had to have this strong finite dimensionality condition. And similarly, fusion category is a very strong finite dimensional finite dimensionality condition as well, right? So this is something now we want to relax, because you might have an example of a tensor category that you want to interpret, but it does not have that condition. So maybe one example I will write for you is here. You can characterize what this finite dimensionality condition is, which is called dualizability. So 2-dualizable here means that it's, we're over C, semi-simple over C and finitely generated. And projective. So finite dimensional over C. So you see again, I mean, for an algebra to be finite dimensional over C, that's already a really strong property, right? Separability, semi-simplicity even more. Okay, the problem is though that this was a nice framework, very clean framework, but there are theories that you would like to study where this is just not true. You just don't have that. So for example, you might, instead of getting a map from C to C, you might instead here, actually instead, get a line, or maybe even worse, a vector space. So if you think this is what's usually called an anomaly line, so for example, even already in Siegel's conformal field theories, this is a problem. You have something like a projective line. So you don't really have the specified line. But also like in Reshetyk-Turayev theory, this is an issue. Or like, I mean, space of conformal blocks is such a vector space where you're relative to. And so this relative version now, we have our assignment, which our field theory, which should be relative to this T. So this is the thing that we now want to axiomatize. So. So we will look later at examples of topological situations, but really field theories. So there are different ways to implement this. So certainly something that is a good notion of something like that would be a bulk boundary theory, like a defect theory. But that, again, imposes conditions which may be too strong. And depending on your theory, that will be very good, but possibly you don't have that much. So if you have a bulk boundary theory, something like that, where here you have the boundary, maybe you don't have the property that you know how to evaluate the bulk field, bulk theory on all of these. Maybe you only know how to evaluate them in little neighborhoods of the boundary. And so then this bulk boundary formulation might be too strong. Maybe you just don't have that much. And so what we will talk about now is a weaker notion. And this goes back to, I guess, Stefan Stolz and Peter Teichner, this idea. And they called it twisted field theory, which has nothing to do with the twists that you guys are probably familiar with. But that's how it is. And so the idea now is that what did we have? Our theory Let me just be a little agnostic at the moment. No matter what Bordism category we have here, we before always wanted to have a functor into this possible target C. Now we won't just have, I mean, let me start again. We want to get the situation where our Z actually is not a function, is more like a morphism from C to this twist vector space here. Okay. So we want to implement that we have some sort of a morphism from the constant theory C to a theory that we call T, which is the twist, the anomaly. So we can first get the twist here. And this will land in a modification of C, which I don't really want to discuss in detail today. But the property will be that n-dimensional manifolds are sent to vector spaces. And then here we can put the constant theory, C, that evaluates to C on everything. And now I want a good notion of morphism between them. So for symmetric monoidal functors, there's a good notion between them, namely natural transformation. And there are particularities about this. Namely, we actually want something called a lax or an oblax natural transformation. And this will be a higher category as well. So for having a category here and a bi-category here, this was what Scholz and Teichner did. And if we have this higher categorical situation, then Theo and I actually gave definitions of this and constructed a framework to treat these. So we won't really need to understand very well what these guys are, because I will give you a characterization similarly to this one here. Okay, so in the topological situation, we can really kind of characterize what these guys are. And we get some things like on this side. And we will kind of discuss these n-dualizability conditions in this context for n equals 1 and n equals 2, maybe. Yes?
So for C tilde, should I just think of C tilde as being one of these categories?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So if this is an n vector, 3 vector, 3D looping of vectors, then this will be an n plus 1 vector. That's what it should be. So this is a good example for n equals 2. This is a good example for n equals 1. Okay. So let's look at the characterization. And this here, I should say, this uses the cobordism hypothesis, which is the theorem over there, this here. And I haven't been very good at names. I should really mention this cobordism hypothesis. This was first formulated by Beitz and Dolan. There's an extensive sketch of proof by Jacob Lurie, and also a new approach by Ayala Francis. So our characterization uses that theorem. But in this situation, we can give a full characterization, namely equivalent R in a good sense. These twisted field theories. And again, this goes by evaluating at a point. So what happens if I evaluate at a point now? If I evaluate at a point, this thing, I know what this means. I will just get C. And on the side here, I will get T of the point. And this natural transformation will give me a map like this. So this will be a morphism in C. with certain properties. And let's do an example, because so far this was very abstract. So in the one-dimensional situation, I can take just, as before, my cobordism one category with the orientation, and I want to map it into something over here, which is this good delooping. So for example, I can take this one. So this is, I will just call this ALG. So here I wanted to have C. Here I want to have some algebra. And now what is, what will the morphism be that I can determine this by? Well, I want to have a map from C to A, morphism in ALG, which is the same thing. If we look over there in our list, what was a morphism? It was a bimodule. Something like this. And now the property is that what I want M is finitely presented and projective over. And now there are two flavors here. Okay. There two different flavors. So one is I just do it over C. This is what's called the lax situation. The other flavor is just over A. This is the oblax condition. So if we have this situation here, we're back to the same story that we had in the very beginning. We just had finite dimensionality, right? Here. But if we're in the other situation, we're just asking for this relative to A, which is a lot weaker. So an example that you can take, the in some sense stupid example, let's take A as a CA bimodule, okay? And then, of course, this condition is satisfied for the second situation. Without any finite dimensionality.
Claudia?
Yes?
We want to know which one is the physically correct one.
Of the two?
Yeah.
They might both be correct for two different purposes.
Yes.
Right. So.
Yeah. This n equals 1 case is a little bit misleading because the distinction will disappear for n equals 2 and higher. Then you actually, in fact, get the same condition. You get a lax theory if and only if you get an oblax theory, which is like because of topological reasons. So in that sense, I don't know because for one-dimensional situations, I mean, this is really just the one-dimensional case where you see a difference.
So here you get things associated to one-dimensional manifolds.
And codimensional.
A cylinder.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. And so in some sense, like because you just have a cylinder, like, you don't have enough space to turn something around. And in higher dimensions, you can do that. Mm-hmm. That's somehow the visual property of why this funny thing happens.
But is it all causal duality? So this cylinder can have two ends where one has oblax and the other has lax?
Mm-hmm.
Can that happen?
Can you say that again?
Might have the same two-dimensional theory with two different boundary conditions, the way we think about it, or?
You mean the thing where I just said lax is equal to oblax?
No,
in one dimension.
Yes.
I could have a maybe some, I don't, I'm not going to get lex and uplex correct,
sure.
but I could have a twist from C to A and another twist from A to C.
Yeah,
presumably one of them has one of these and the other has the other.
Yes, absolutely. So the point is you can compose these theories if they have the same flavor. So if I have another one here, I can compose them if this is lax and this is lax, right? But then if I look at this situation, well, then definitely one of them, either this or that one, will have the finite dimensionality over A, over C, I'm sorry. So always a strong condition. So somehow if you want to get this and this, then you still need the strong condition.
So one of them, you're saying one of them will be finite dimensional over C, and the other one will be finite dimensional
yes.
over A.
One is finite dimensional over the input, and one is finite dimensional over the output.
And the tensor products will be finite dimensional over C, because...
Well, if I want to have both this theory and this theory, if I take lax on both of them, lax will just require me to have finite dimensional over the input. So I need finite dimensional over C for this one, and finite dimensional over A for this one. Now if I choose oplex for both of them, then this first one requires me to be finite dimensional over A, and the second one requires me to be finite dimensional over C. So this here will usually only give me one of the two, not both, unless I have the strong finite dimensionality condition, in which I'm back on the previous case. But I could put this one here, and I could put something else here. And that might work. Right.
But if they are both lax, then the composition is automatically a full theory.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So this is also something I didn't mention previously, something Theo and I showed. If you take C, T to also be C, then actually you get back the previous notion valued in the loop of this.
It would be a bad notion if it didn't have that.
Yes.
Theories on the slabs.
Okay, but let's look at another example. So take V, any vector space, possibly non-finite dimensional. And we can look at V as a bimodule over its endomorphisms. So I reversed the roles just now, so I don't want to really be too pedantic about which one is in and which one is out. This is a natural way to look at it. And then actually, we again have, well, we need the finiteness condition over C for one of the two, but with the finiteness condition over end V for the other one. And this is always satisfied. So even if V is non-finite dimensional, but if I remember right, it's the oplex one. But
you told us it was hard to get lax ones. So both of these must be oplex.
Well, this one is hard to get laxly, but now I reverse the roles, right?
Oh, sorry, I didn't see that.
But I think you still get an oplex one. I'm not sure.
So you think V is kind of perfect as an end V module?
Yes. So if we don't have any topology on the vector space, this is always true. If we have topological vector space, there are mild conditions, which, I mean, for example, a sufficient condition is that there is a V, little v in V, and a lambda in V dual such that lambda V is 1. That's enough. So if you have a Banach space, you have like a Hahn-Banach theorem or something like that. So you want something very mild on your vector space. But if you don't have any topology floating around, it's always satisfied. Did I get the direction wrong? It might be that this is lax.
I just want to know if I can compose the two examples that you told me. If I set A to be end of V, and I compose them, I think I get V.
Yes, this will be lax, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yes, because this here has the condition over the right side, and this has the condition over the left side. So they have to have the other flavor. Lax means that it has the flavor over this side, and oplex means it has the flavor over that side. And so they're different, right? Okay, so now we can go and try to realize that this was somehow a warm-up case. One-dimensional with boundaries, not so interesting yet. Now, if we go in higher dimensions, we're trying to find interesting examples that fit into this framework, but not necessarily fit into the absolute framework. And for this, I have to tell you a little bit about a possible target. So if we now go up one dimension, so we use this n equals 2 example over here for a one-dimensional target, now we will need another target for the n equals 2-dimensional situation. So this one would be a possible target, right? But we actually haven't tried it, like we don't have the example in this framework yet. We have a slightly different target. So now, so rather, I will, and again, we have this frame situation. So we will also generalize this algebras, bimodules, intertwiner example, but in a slightly different way. Will be something I will call ALG2. So this is a 3 category. So what are the objects here? And this will be an informal description. So the objects here will be what's called an E2 algebra. So let me explain what this is. So an example is a braided monoidal category. So here we're taking E2 algebras in categories. E2 algebra means roughly that you have two algebra structures which are compatible with each other. So one of them is the monoidal structure, and the other one, somehow the braiding tells you how they're compatible. So this is an good example. If we just take vector spaces here, an E2 algebra in vector spaces will just be a commutative algebra. So if you kind of want to forget about E2, it's perfectly fine to just think about commutative algebras. And if you take something like more of a derived flavor, like chain complexes, then the structure that you have is what's called a P2 algebra structure. So it has a commutative multiplication and a Poisson bracket of degree. Is it minus 1 or plus 1?
Minus 1.
So 1 minus 2, right? That's the formula. So these are the kind of examples that you can keep in mind. And so these are just my objects. And I want to think of them kind of pictorially. So somehow.
So is this kind of the things are relative to?
Yes. So somehow the picture of the E2 algebra is you get a multiplication for any somehow. Yeah, let's take this. This is a little R2 now. And so for any inclusion of two little disks, you get a multiplication structure here. So in the commutative algebra, well, I mean, you just assign the same thing to all of them. Okay. So, but think really of this example. So modular tensor categories in particular are objects in here. And so now what will morphisms be? morphisms will be my bimodules in a good sense. So think of this algebra as having these two algebra structures. Now you take one of these, fix one of these, and you take a bimodule for that one. But now you're still left with the other algebra structure. So I can put here something like bimodules of bimodules. And then I have three morphisms, which are just now the analog of the homomorphisms. So this here, if I take this example, this category situation, this is somehow the prospective target of a Reshetukin Toraev theory, exactly because the modular tensor categories are the objects that give me these 3D or even 4D TFTs, 3D. But somehow the idea is that now we want to, again, relax conditions, right? So I want to look at this target and try to understand what happens with this. And it's fine if you just think of this commutative case. Okay, so here it's very helpful. The following proposition is very helpful. Namely, we need to use this characterization in this particular case of C tilde. And it's a corollary of Theo and my characterization and another theorem, which says that in ALT2 as a two category is fully two dualizable. So that means that objects are two dualizable and morphisms have left and right adjoints, whatever. It's not so important. But the corollary of those two, this as a corollary, is that if I now take a morphism in this category, it determines an oblax or lax, and again, this is now the same condition. And now there are funny conditions that happen. And I will probably get the direction wrong, but M has to be finitely presented and projective over A.
Sorry, M is an E1 bimodule between the two algebras.
Yes, it's a morphism in here.
When you write finitely presented and projective, do you mean as and just as a vector space over A, or do you mean
just as a module? So it is a module over A. I forget the E1 structure. Okay. Just view it as a module.
So this is the analog of the before you had an associative algebra, it was finitely measured over C.
Yes, exactly. So this is the analogous situation here. And so this is the first one. M is separable over A. So this means it's finitely presented and projective over. And so now M here still has an algebra structure. So I can do something like this. So if you think about the commutative case, just pretend A is commutative for a minute. Then, I mean, this makes sense. M still is an algebra itself. So I can ask for this. In the non-commutative case, you have to be a little precise what you mean by this. I'm happy to explain this later. But the separability condition is the analog of the semi-simplicity here.
So this is the condition that Tonsevich calls smooth.
Yes, absolutely.
On A is the
derived. Absolutely. In the derived situation, it's precisely that. But again, like it's for this E2 situation.
But
so it's a little, yeah. It's a little tricky.
So you said that both lax and oplax require both 1 and 2?
Yes.
And there's no B at all?
Nope.
Okay.
And that's the surprising thing about it. Or maybe not surprising, but if you look at this, these two conditions are exactly the correct generalizations if we're not over C. And if you're in this commutative case, it really is a weaker condition. This one will imply that one, if A is finite over C.
Do you think these conditions are secretly symmetric between A and B? Is that what you're saying?
No, but the they're not at all. Like B really does not show up. But to be a lax or oplex theory does not depend on B at all.
Okay. So the direction of the RL.
Yes. So what happens is that if you look at the evaluation and correlation maps, they will basically, for them to have just a one-sided adjoint, you will have the conditions over always just over something with A. And the other one just doesn't appear. But that's similar like the situation all the way at the end, right? For the lax or oplex, we only also had like either over A or over B a condition.
In the original case, if I had a boundary which was some condition, I knew how to turn it around and get a boundary on the other side with the other condition.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're saying that I don't like...
Yes. So there are four conditions you can write down for two dualizability, and we're picking out two of them. And one could argue that maybe it was a choice that we made of how to define lax or oplex, that we chose the one that picked out exactly those two and not the other two. What you could do is you could tweak your target category by doing like a op of just the one morphisms, just the odd morphisms or something like this. Then you would get the other condition. But that's not so important.
I think that Johnson, Fred, and Schanbauer have very good reasons for setting up the definitions.
I agree. I agree. And believe me, when we found this, I was very puzzled because I expected, again, one of them to give one condition and the other to give the other condition. And I went back through our proof and checked it very carefully. But okay, so far this again is just abstract nonsense. What's the example that we want to look at? So I want to generalize example two. So the philosophy somehow of generalizing so far was to take a vector space and turn it into an algebra. So now I need a new name for an algebra. Give me a good name for an algebra because we already had A and B. What do you want?
R.
R, okay. R usually is commutative for me, but
okay.
Whatever. So now we had the example, the endomorphisms of the vector space. And the claim is that the correct generalization here is to take the center, or the derived center. So the derived center, it's clearer that it's really the analog of the endomorphisms, but let's just take the usual center. So if you don't like derived, you can just think of the ordinary center. The ordinary center is a commutative algebra. More generally, this will be the Hochschild cohomology of R, which is an E2 algebra by Dielin's conjecture. And they will act. So I will get a bimodule. So here I had V as an endomorphisms C bimodule. So here I will look at R as a Z of R C bimodule, or whatever my ground field is. And now I want to ask for these two conditions. And actually, these two conditions, so this satisfies 1 and 2, if and only if A, R, is Azumaya over its center.
Is this the definition Azumaya gave? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
So these conditions really are equivalent to being Azumaya over its center. So there are elements in the Brouwer group. So interesting new conditions that show up. But especially in this commutative setting where this is all well studied, this here really is a proper, like really a weaker condition than the one over there. In the derived situation, it's not so clear. In the derived situation, it's really not, we tried a lot already to search the literature for what these conditions are, but it seems that it's not really very worked out.
Are you suggesting that it's easier to be Azumaya over in the underived world than it is to be Azumaya in a derived sense?
That I don't know, but what I know is that being Azumaya over K implies being Azumaya over the center of R. Or even just having these two conditions over K imply being Azumaya over its center.
Okay.
So separability, for example, you can do like M is separable over K if and only if M is separable over A and A is separable over K. There's a transitivity property. But for the derived situation, we don't know if this is true. There seems to like have been not that much yet in like studied over these things.
So you're saying in the derived situation, you don't know examples or you don't know the right conditions?
I don't know examples. So the conditions are these two.
So did you know if a polynomial ring satisfies this in the derived center? A free polynomial algebra?
No, I don't know. So the only good example that I have at the moment is if you take the Weyl algebra and characteristic P. So this will certainly satisfy this. But at the moment, we don't really have good other examples yet, although there should be.
Universal Adelphi algebra is not so far.
Sorry?
Universal Adelphi algebra is not so far from here.
That should be, yes. So we're trying.
Do you have a...
What example?
Sorry, well, I think I was going to ask the same thing. Do you have a generalization of example one? You told us how to generalize example two.
Yes, example one just goes through.
And on which side? I guess I can guess. It must be A over A.
Yes. That's like the trivial case, the stupid case in some sense.
That one always works.
That works in all dimensions. For you who knows the story about factorization algebras, Stolz and Teichner have this project, I guess including us now, that there should be a, like starting with the factorization algebra, the factorization algebra should determine you a twist functor. Plus, somehow factorization algebras are pointed because you can always include the empty set everywhere, and that will give such a functor. But that's the analog of this stupid example.
Now I'm confused because when you wrote that there before, that was the A was on the right.
Yes.
But you told us conditions were always left-handed in the 2D case. So are you saying that to preserve condition example one, I have to switch whether
yes,
I have to
you
do
have
a
to switch
kind of co-twisted rather than twisted?
Yes.
So are there examples with braided?
So with braided monoidal, this example you mean?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet. So what we're trying at the moment is it seems that there should be natural examples for this target here. The analogous situation for that other side, but that's because dualizability in this category has already been studied quite a bit by Douglas Shumma-Priest and Snyder. But in this situation, I don't know, and I would be happy to kind of find examples of this. It should be a weakening of modular tensor category, and the hope would be that it would be kind of modular tensor category over something easier. That would be the guess, but...
Like what about here? Is it like fusion
rather
than Drinfeld center?
Well, I don't think it should be the Drinfeld center.
Okay.
Because I mean you're taking kind of something that lies in here, right? So it should be like a finite tensor category. Now you take its center. And now you want it to be like fusion relative to that. So you're taking like a finite category, there's no tensor structure yet.
Mm-hmm.
For that you can just take the center. And now it should be fusion relative to that. So the philosophy is always like it's relative to its observables in some sense. But yeah, this is a playground now.
So this should go in things like orbifolds of vertex algebras which are not rational. I don't know.
You tell me. I mean, this would be great. Like, I mean, I really hope that there are examples like that that fit into this framework. But at the moment, I just don't know like the other sides of the story well enough yet.
Well, I mean, boundary conditions for 3D games. Topological boundary conditions for 3D games.
No, that's like that should sound good.
Yeah. So any bulk boundary theory should give one of these. But there somehow, like, you have much stronger conditions to be a bulk boundary theory.
Yeah, so here's one of the boundaries extendable onto the bulk. No.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
And not here the boundaries we have extendable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, of course, every such situation will give one of these, but the actually really interesting examples would be where you don't have this extra dualizability of the bulk, sorry.
Yeah.
But yes, if somebody has suggestions for examples, please, we'd be happy to have some. I did not mention this last part of this, like endomorphisms and the V, that's joint work with Owen William. Yeah. Thank you.
We already started questions, are there more?
We started questions after the first 5 minutes.
That's true.
No, I mean, really, like, I mean, at the moment, we're just kind of trying to, you know, but there have been several results on finite dimensionality conditions in all of these categories, and now you have to kind of search the literature and go through and try to match them up. But this is something where we're still kind of working on it.
Have you guys looked at, I mean, this is maybe the same question Davide already asked. So there's E2 algebras, like, as you said, in vector spaces are fairly boring, they're commutative. I can make them unboring by talking about, by moving to a derived world, mm-hmm. which is too hard for me. Or I can make them unboring by not doing E2, but doing more like, say, holomorphic factorization.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any speculations about what would happen if I did that?
Okay, you want to replace the E2 algebra by a holomorphic factorization algebra?
Is that, I mean, that's almost the picture you drew.
That's a great question.
I mean, you could say that you'll speculate, but not while you're on the microphone.
Yes, absolutely, but I mean, is this turned off yet? I mean, again, it should be somehow the philosophy should always be what you put here. I mean, it should be somehow a module for that holomorphic factorization algebra, right? What you put here should have like some relative finiteness to the holomorphic factorization algebra. What that means in translation, I don't know. I mean, do you have
guesses? I mean, drawing lines in the complex plane is always a weird thing to me. It's mixing real and complex geometry.
Yes.
But maybe if you did a similar thing when to the E3 version, then you had a holomorphic factorization algebra replacing the E2 one.
Mm-hmm. You mean in?
So on the boundary, you have something holomorphic and the bulk was topological.
Ah, you want the boundary holomorphic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very familiar situation.
Yes.
But then your conditions look like they can be expressed in the, you know, instead of having this thing about M tensor over M at A, you take the factorization homology on the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
You get an associative algebra.
Yeah, that's.
Which Davide and I were looking at for some reason, but
oh, really? Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should talk. We should
what
talk.
What are those conditions there? Although.
So I mean, the nice thing is that I mean, all these things were expressed, of course, in terms of factorization algebras on R, and so here you just see very explicitly what these like adjoints and so on are, just by kind of string diagram computations, mm-hmm. essentially. So I think like anytime you can express these things as factorization algebras, you should be able to understand what conditions it gives for you to kind of do these turning around conditions. But if you have the E3 situation and you put something holomorphic on this thing in the middle, I mean, it won't really lie in this thing, right? But that's okay. You could like, I mean, it's a different target category.
Yeah, I suppose then you run into the issue of bimodules between two vertex algebras. I don't know what that means.
Yeah. But somehow the other thing is that we have a feeling that these like pictures here should also give kind of hints on what to do like in more complicated categories, right? Because you can always translate these conditions that you just can read off from the pictures into these more complicated targets.
I feel that modular invariance in non-rational theories could be a place where these things can happen.
Well, we should, I mean, Schweigert et al. Just put out yet another paper on logarithmic CFTs that is worth looking at.
Yeah, you
mentioned
that.
I haven't
yet
looked at it yet. Any further questions? No, we should thank Claudia again.